That was Michael Parenti speaking on the hidden ideology of the news media. To obtain copies of this talk or for more info about Dr. Parenti's work, visit his website at www.michaelparenti.org. You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva and WXXE Fenner Syracuse.
The May 2000 issue of the Book Press, which is an Ithaca literary arts newspaper, has a front page article called Toxic Dreams, whose first paragraph runs as follows. Quote, an open landfill, an uncapped, uncleaned, 65-acre open dump exists within the city of Ithaca. Hundreds of residents live directly on top of the northern portion of this dump in Nate's Floral Estates mobile home park, owned by local physician Reuben Weiner. The site is located in a floodplain and is bordered by two bodies of water that drain directly into Cayuga Lake. Mayor Alan Cohen knows this. The Tompkins County Health Department knows this. The New York State and Federal Environmental Protection Agencies know this. But in all likelihood, the reason Ithacans know the dump's name, Southwest Park, is because our city government is planning on redeveloping the area in hopes of boosting the local economy. End quote. How a story about toxic waste and economic development ended up running in Ithaca's monthly literary newspaper instead of either the daily newspaper, the Ithaca Journal, or the weekly Ithaca Times is a story in itself. And today we have Kara Benyakov, who wrote the story Toxic Dreams, to speak with us on Unwelcome Guests. She used to be a reporter in Buffalo on urban environmental issues. Welcome to Unwelcome Guests.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So maybe we could start by just having you tell our listeners a little bit about the story that you wrote and who you wrote it for and how it ended up getting into the book press.
Yeah, okay. Back in April, I found basically a small article that had been written by Walter Hang, just a brief about environmental problems within the city that had been run actually again in the book press. And I thought that this was a sort of a good jumping-off point to talk about urban environmental problems, which is what I used to write about for another paper. So back in April, I pitched the story to the Ithaca Times, and what I wanted to do was I wanted to interview Walter Hang, who is the president of a firm called Toxics Targeting, and he's also the co-author of the New York State Community Right to Know Executive Order, which requires disclosure to the state's Department of Environmental Conservation of industrial and commercial dumping practices. So Walter had a whole bunch of information about toxic dumps within the city, where they were, and some of the things that were in them, some of the chemicals that were in them. And I pitched this story to the then editor of the Ithaca Times, Vivek Apte, who seemed pretty enthusiastic about it and said, you know, to go ahead, and that sounded like a great story. So I then began to do a little research. I went to the library and I talked to Walter Hang and did an interview with him. And I had originally considered just having the piece be an interview with Walter. Then Vivek quit the Ithaca Times, and their staff reporter, Chris First, sort of took over in place of him. And he seemed even more enthusiastic about running the story, and I got a lot of encouragement, you know, to do it. So I went ahead, and I did the interview with Walter, and I found a whole bunch, or really was given a whole bunch of information by Walter Hang, things that date back to 1986 that document the hazards and the environmental problems that are on these development sites. I also did an interview with Alan Cohen, and I also interviewed people from the DEC and basically had a pretty solid story, a great interview, and some really great quotes from the mayor, who really didn't seem to have any concern at all about these environmental problems. And what happened was I turned the story in and basically had it handed right back to me and was told, you know, this just isn't going to fly. You're going to have to make some changes. You're going to have to do some more interviews. You know, we're not going to run it as just an interview with Walter Hang because we're going to get sued. Their main concern was they were going to get sued for libel. Also, there was a lot of information about the owner of Nate's Floral Estates, Reuben Weiner. They were very afraid that Reuben Weiner was going to sue them. Mm-hmm. So what I did was I contacted some more people. I conducted some more interviews. I put together what I thought was a pretty powerful piece. It really is. It's actually word for word the piece that runs in the book press if anybody wants to pick it up and see how libelous it may or may not be. And the evening of the day before it was supposed to run, I handed it in, and I'd been there all day trying to get a hold of, you know, congressmen and representatives and politicians and, you know, people in the know at the EPA and the DEC, and handed the story in. And they were going to give the story, supposedly, to their lawyers. And then I was, you know, whatever. I was on my way to pick up my son from school, and then I was going to go home. Meanwhile, what was going on simultaneously at the Ithaca Times office that I was unaware of is that they were putting together the real piece that they were going to run on the cover the next day, which was a story about the SPCA and how good it is to adopt dogs and cats, which, of course, it is. But so that's what happened. They basically told me they were going to run the story, knowing full well that they had no intention of running the story. And the next day I went to the office and, you know, when the paper came out, took my story back and took it over to Jack Goldman, who...
The editor of the book
press. The editor of the book press, who has no problem running something that talks about local politics.
Mm-hmm. So tell me what you're... Do you have any explanation for why the Ithaca Times might have decided not to run your story?
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of explanations, I suppose. I mean, I fault myself for not figuring out all the signs that they were not going to run it in the first place. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of things. They had asked Walter Hang repeatedly for maps of the site, which he had produced, you know, on his own time and had his people produce, and then he would hand them in to them, and they would say, this isn't good, we need another one, and this had been going on and on, you know, and it was really quite clear that, you know, stuff that they could have easily dealt with in terms of production at the paper, they wanted Walter to do as some sort of stalling technique. That was a real tip-off. I think, you know, the major reason they didn't run it is because I went and I interviewed Alan Cohen, and Alan Cohen basically told me lies about what was going on. You know, he said that that what was going on at Southwest Park in terms of the toxins that were buried there and the risk to the public were you know, that those things weren't a problem, and that whoever bought that land and moved in was going to clean it up, and that the city was going to get money for it. And, you know, it's absolutely untrue. Representative Brodsky has said that, told me, quoted to me, that you know, that's absolutely, it would be illegal for such practices to occur. And so this is, you know, Cohen's line to the city of Ithaca, which is, everything's okay, it's not a problem, the site isn't toxic, and anyway, we need the industry to come in, and when the industry comes in, they're going to take care of it, and everything's going to be all right. So shortly after that interview with Cohen, it became really apparent that there was a really hostile attitude about what was going on with the story. My story also, I went out of the office for 15 minutes, and my story also, part of it mysteriously disappeared when the computer mysteriously crashed. So, I mean, there was certain thing. I mean, like, not to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but it was just, it was pretty obvious that the story wasn't going to run.
Now, some of our listeners aren't from the Ithaca area, and even some of those who are from the Ithaca area might not know some of the details about why Southwest Park, which is the area of Ithaca that your story is about in part, is such a hot political issue these days. So maybe you could give a little bit of background about why and how Southwest Park has been in the news recently.
Yeah, well, Southwest Park's in the news because the city of Ithaca is planning on developing the site and bringing in big boxes. box stores. Now, you know, Ithacans are really upset and, you know, freaked out about stuff like big box stores. And if you remember back to the Walmart thing that happened a number of years ago, you know, how I feel about development of the site is entirely different from how I feel about not, you know, there not being disclosure of the fact that the site has, I have a list here of the number of toxins that are actually buried there. There's like dozens and dozens of things there, you know, fluorine, anthracene, lead, mercury, selenium, silver, arsenic. It's a 65-acre site, and it's been there for years and years, and there's pollutants there that are just really, really not good for anybody to breathe or come into any contact with. The site is also not capped and not cleaned, and it really means that anything that gets built there is going to just filter right through what gets built over it and have contact with human beings, as it does right now in the trailer park that's built on it. So people are concerned about Southwest Park, and they're thinking, oh, we don't want to, you know, among other things, among being concerned about the economy, they're also worried about, you know, what it's going to do to the environment there, which right. is sort of ironic because right. they're completely unaware of the fact that, right. you know, the environment there is already messed up.
So the debate that's happening about Southwest Park, I mean, whatever side people might want to take in that debate, I mean, everyone has an interest in all the information, all the relevant information being brought out. Tell me, where this list of toxins that you're reading from, what is that document that you're reading?
What this is a study generated by Toxics Targeting, which is Walter Hang's organization, his business. And I guess I should go into a little bit more into what exactly the problem with the site is. The site should be a Superfund site. Mm-hmm. Back in 1986, both the EPA and the Tompkins County Health Department did some studies there, and some surface soil studies, and found things that were highly toxic and recommended immediately that, you know, wells be dug and that tests be done. The Tompkins County Health Department and the EPA recommended that proper steps be undertaken to protect the people who were living on the site, but also to completely discourage further development, that steps must be taken so that everyone knew, it was disclosed to everyone what the story was with the site.
Now, this is interesting to me because I just read that there was an environmental impact statement released relevant to the Southwest Park site. I just read about that in the Ithaca Journal.
Absolutely. And it was a firm out of Rochester called Clark Patterson Associates. And they conducted this environmental impact study of the site. And the study, their own study, which was the study that the city had, revealed that there was 37 highly toxic chemicals, pollutants, and heavy metals. And that was a surface testing. So even though you have back in the 80s this request to have an extensive study done, you know, it's 1999 and the city is still having this outside firm come in and then test again only the soil and then tell the public again, this is fine, we can build here. Mm-hmm. When I'm sure that Clark Patterson knows that, you know, anyone who is conducting the test would know that serious study needs to continue of the site. Yeah.
I have one question about the other newspaper in Ithaca, the Ithaca Journal. Have they ever covered any of these issues?
Walter Hang had a press release, and the Ithaca Journal covered, he had a press conference and put out a press release and had a press conference by the site. And they gave it, you know, a few paragraphs. Missy Gloverman covered it. But again, sort of with the spin on it that everything was okay, and that, you know, the Clark Patterson report said this, and the mayor said this, and mm-hmm. everything was okay.
Right, but I take it that Walter Hang doesn't think that everything's okay.
No. Walter Hang doesn't think everything's okay. Yeah. Citizens to Save Cayuga Lake don't think everything's okay. You know, Cayuga Lake Defense Fund doesn't think everything's okay, and neither did the DEC and the EPA mm-hmm. and the Tompkins County Health Department mm-hmm. think that everything was okay.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard people say that there seems to be a conflict of interest in the journal's coverage of the Southwest Park development and in lots of development issues in Ithaca, because they stand to gain hugely financially if big, you know, new stores come into Ithaca who could be potential advertisers.
Absolutely. I mean, my take on it is that the Ithaca Journal is pretty much, you know, it's a Gannett newspaper. It's a corporate newspaper. I don't think they think very seriously about what they're putting out. I don't think that they function as a good local paper should. They are supposedly going to run another story on Southwest Park, on the environmental concerns, but they're waiting an entire month to do that, and I don't know why, if they're researching or collecting data or they're waiting for something else to happen. But again, they've been relatively disinterested and sort of putting it on the back burner. And the Ithaca Times... Absolutely. I mean, the Ithaca Times is totally run out of its advertising department. It's a cash cow, and they certainly stand to gain a lot if the big box stores come in.
Okay, Kara, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about what happened when you went to visit the Southwest Park site?
Yeah, I went to Nate's Floral Estates, the trailer park there, to see if I could get some interviews with some of the residents and... just to look around, actually. And I guess the most upsetting thing is that the site itself is... The trailer park has certain spots in which trailers have been moved and the ground is dug up. And there are, on the outskirts of the site, you know, 55-gallon drums of things that are leaking. There's a partially buried car. There are all the types of things that you would find in an open dump right there, right near these people's houses, near their neighborhood, near their gardens. And so I drove around a little bit in Nate's and observed some of these things and talked to a few of the residents there. And most of them didn't want to talk to me, obviously, because I was from the paper and, you know, they didn't want to be involved. I talked to one person who'd been living there for 40 years, and he told me that, you know, he knew that it had been a dump, but he also knew that, you know, it wasn't policy for the owners of Nate's to tell people when they were moving in that it had been a dump, that people were living on a dump. And he didn't think that any of the younger people who were living there knew that it was a dump. And then I went and tried to get just a couple of quotes from the administration there, mm-hmm. and was threatened with arrest. You know, I was completely shut out. As soon as they found out I was with the press, they, you know, shut themselves into an inner office and started, you know, telling me that if I didn't leave, they would call the police. And then they either called or pretended to call the police. I'm not quite sure what was going on there. But it was a totally, you know, we don't know anything. And that's it. You know, we don't even claiming, you know, we don't know who owns, you know, the place. You have to talk to the owner and we can't give you any information about him. So obviously they know that there's something going on, that there's, you know, some suspicion that things aren't quite kosher over there.
Right. And presumably the owner of this land and of the trailer park doesn't himself live.
Yeah, right. No. Right. And presumably a physician knows what substances like benzene can do to the human body.
Yeah, what are some of the health effects of some of these chemicals?
Benzene, I guess, is the most toxic chemical found at the site, and it's a known human carcinogen, even at low levels of exposure. And the way people are coming into contact with this is, you know, through dust in their house, through the ground, through things that are getting blown, wind that's getting blown in. I mean, it gets absorbed right through your skin. My concern would be that there are families living there, that there are children living there, and that, you know, children are, there's also, you know, a creek running by there. And so, you know, you have families, children digging in the dirt by their homes and playing in the creek by, you know, their homes in their neighborhoods, that they're obviously coming into contact with this stuff. Ethyl benzene is there, and that causes irritation to eyes and the skin and problems in the central nervous system. And in cases of greater exposure, it could cause someone to go into a coma. Dichloral benzene can cause skin blistering and damage to the eyes and nausea and vomiting and weight loss and damage to the internal organs like the liver and kidneys. And these are just, you know, these are just, what, four or five examples of some of the things that are buried there. So you would assume that if you were a physician and you owned this property, you would be well aware of the kind of health risks that it posed to the residents.
Yeah.
For a reporter to go into a situation like that and to get that kind of information and to speak to the people who are living there and to make contact with the people who are living there and to have that information be known to the newspaper, to the editors of the newspaper, to the publisher of the newspaper, it's completely and totally immoral that the newspaper would then not run the story, that they would be so frightened of being sued for libel, which, you know, of course they couldn't be sued for libel maybe because these are all well-researched, well-quoted, thoroughly investigated allegations. Not even allegations, really. These are facts. And for the newspaper to not run this story, to sit on this story, and instead to run a fluff piece, it's completely wrong. They're literally, the residents of this place are being exposed to these toxins, are being put at risk for cancer and risk for other disease because of the fact that the paper is sitting on the story. It's completely wrong.
Now, you say that the story that the Times ended up running, they did run a story on this topic maybe a week later, was it?
Yeah, I think it was about 2 or 3 weeks later. Right. And what it was is, Walters continued to do research and have had the DEC come in and do studies. And what's happened is they found 29 other sites in the county. The story that the Times ran focused mostly on Teberg, and it was written very much like a fluff piece. It certainly didn't have a journalistic edge to it. It was, again, what we see very, very commonly now in the press, this sort of, oh dear, how did that happen kind of take to it. Now, we know how these things happen. We know who the responsible parties are, and we can hold them accountable, or we can choose to act like this is, you know, oh geez, I used to play in this stream, and gosh, look what happened. I mean, that's just not the case. That's just not how these things work. And if the press is going to be so afraid of suit, or I don't even know. I mean, I can't even tell you what I think, you know, they're actually afraid of. It seems that they're going to be afraid of losing advertising.
So it's part of it. Sounds like it must be that they want the advertising from these stores that might be built in Southwest Park. And part of it is that perhaps they don't want to destroy their relationship with local politicians like the mayor.
Certainly, certainly. Yeah. I mean, the major concern, major concern with the Ithaca Times is that, you know, the mayor, I supposedly made the mayor look like a fool. Now, the mayor made himself look like a fool. The mayor had no information on the site. When he went and supposedly did his homework on it, he came back and had a whole bunch of things to tell me that were completely inaccurate. So we can assume that he's either ignorant or he's lying. So, yeah, they certainly, I mean, the Times doesn't want to destroy its relationship. Jim Belinsky, the publisher of the Times, you know, who's, you know, a wealthy, you know, landlord, which is how he makes his money, and he owns all of the little papers that you read that are around the area, all the Finger Lakes newspapers, doesn't want to mess up his relationship with local politicians, and I guess we can understand that. But the problem is that where do you get information then? And how do you get information? I mean, if there is this kind of blackout, or I wouldn't necessarily call it a blackout, because the Times actually, you know, what they wanted me to do was change my piece completely, and then they would run it. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, they would run it as long as I said what they told me to say.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell us what happened the next day after they ran the story about the SPCA?
Well, obviously I was very upset. You know, I had all night to sort of stew about it, and I was pretty upset. And I called the editor and Chris first and said, you know, what is the story here? You know, you're stringing me along, and you're not shooting me straight, et cetera, et cetera. And you know, he was still acting like, well, we just want you to make some changes, and we're going to run it next time, and if you make those changes, we're going to run it next time. And, you know, finally, you know, I just said to him, like, you know, look, I don't know who you're kidding. You're not going to run it. I know that you are not going to run the story, and you know that you're not going to run this story, and I want you to just tell me, you know, what the deal is. And he said, no, we're not going to run it. I don't think it's ever going to run. And, you know, it was, in a way, it was great because it was this real moment of cutting through all the BS where he just said, you know, no, you're right, we're not going to run it. And at that point, I did have a chance to talk to him a little bit about the fact that it was politics. It was politics, and that was why it wasn't running. And that it was politics that they are understaffed, and it is politics that they do not have a union, and it is politics that, you know, he doesn't even know if he's going to stay on as the editor because he's been offered an insulting wage, and it is politics that, you know, everybody there is overworked, and to which he eventually, you know, had to agree. But there's such resistance, there's such incredible resistance to the idea that the things that finally manifest themselves in censorship actually have, it's a chain of events, it's a chain reaction, okay? You know, you're not making enough money for it to be worthwhile for you to have research support for things to get done on time, and you're not in a position to make decisions yourself because you're being told what to do by the publisher. And so you're frustrated. And so, I mean, all these things snowball. And, you know, in addition to the fact that people's hearts are really not in the right places here. So mm-hmm. I just wanted to make that point to you that it's politics.
Mm-hmm. Now, Kara, why don't you tell me about these photographs that were taken when you visited Nate's floral estates.
Yeah, Tracy Mayer, the Ithaca Times photographer, went and took some awesome photographs, basically photographic evidence, shots that show people's homes, people's trailers, and their proximity to the actual waste, you know, barrels that are leaking. And like I said before, these, you know, half-buried pieces of machinery and cars and things that are dumped. And that were amazing evidence of how people were actually living there. Now, when the story didn't run, obviously the photographs didn't run. And then when I was forced to run the story in the book press, we really couldn't get a hold of those photographs because they were the property of the Ithaca Times. So, again, there's this sense of, oh, you know, things really aren't that bad. Or, I mean, you know, the book press is great, but it runs with a, you know, an illustration. So you don't have the sort of impact that you would have if you picked up your local newspaper and you read, you know, a story that documents the things that the story documents and then shows you photograph, you know, several, you know, at least a page of photographic evidence. So unfortunately, no one's had access to those.
Yeah, it's interesting that the opposition in Ithaca to certain kinds of development, like these big box stores like Target and Barnes & Noble and Walmart in the past, has sometimes been pegged as elitist in a certain way, that it's only a certain segment of the community. Yet, here's a really interesting case. I mean, this whole story that you've been telling us, I think, is interesting because it belies that characterization of it in certain ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's much more that needs to be done to before development happens. And certainly, I mean, that you can make the argument that it's elitist, you know, that you know, who's going to go and shop downtown at stores that are expensive, and we need a Target, and we need, you know, I really can almost relate to that. I can see where it comes from, even though I don't agree with it. I don't think in the final analysis, I don't think it really is accurate.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the people who live at Nate's Floral Estates, you know, are not, you know, from the crowd of people that people want to associate with, you know, opposition to Walmart, but they're certainly affected by these issues.
Well, they're affected, and I mean, basically the entire city of Ithaca is affected because this site is bordered by, you know, it's on a floodplain, and it's bordered by two bodies of water, and it flows directly into Cayuga Lake. So, you know, this affects our drinking water. The entire city is drinking water. This affects when Ithaca, seeing itself as the enlightened city that it is, and, you know, seeing ourselves as so active and so environmentally conscious, you know, we go out and we swim in the gorge and we swim in the creek and we swim in the lake. You know, we're swimming in toxic waste. And, you know, this is something that an enlightened city, an enlightened population, right, they can take it. They can take hearing this from their local newspapers.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah, and that's, I mean, another interesting aspect, that just to stick with this issue of elitism, I mean, the only place that this could get reported is in a literary newspaper, you know, which is not going to reach a very large audience. I mean, one explanation for why opposition to some of these kinds of development doesn't spread to the larger population might be that the local press just doesn't want to cover it.
Absolutely, and I'm sure there's many other issues that the local press doesn't cover. I mean, it's not just urban environmental problems. You know, there's plenty of other things that, you know, I've over the years pitched to the Ithaca Times, and, you know, they haven't picked up. And it seems that it's really they're out to sell ads, and they're out to run fluff pieces. So, you know, it seems like good stories get pitched, and maybe good stories get assigned, and maybe they are rewritten because an editor has asked somebody to rewrite, and things are turned into fluff, and then that's what you get. So, you know, it's this sort of perpetual dumbing down of the audience, and then saying, well, look, this is what the audience wants.
Right. Why don't you tell us who Walter Hang is, this man that you interviewed for your story?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. Walter Hang, as I said before, is the president of Toxics Targeting. He's just basically a local business person. But he's been working on environmental issues now, he went to school in Buffalo, and he's been working on environmental issues now for 20-some years. He also wrote, you know, the legislation that's now being used. He wrote the Community Right to Know executive order. Interestingly, Walter Hang has been on the cover of the New York Times twice. He's been on 60 Minutes exposés, and he's pretty much seen nationally as an authority. He lives right here in town, right here in Ithaca. His business is in the DeWitt Mall in the middle of downtown, and the Ithaca Times will not run an interview with him and is not using him as, you know, the authority he is. Instead, you know, when I wrote this piece, there was all these questions, you know, all these questions about, oh, well, you know, who is Walter Hang to say this, and, you know, is he really an authority, and can we really trust him? And, it's interesting that we have access to this kind of information, we have access to this kind of authority, and yet the local media is treating this man and treating this story like it's not news.
All right. Kara, why don't you tell us where people can get more information on this issue and what they can do?
People can get on the internet, if they have access to the internet, and go to www.toxicstargeting.com. People can also write to the Ithaca Times and the Ithaca Journal, and they can ask some serious questions and, you know, demand that they get some information and, you know, ask to see the stories that they want to see. Hopefully that kind of pressure will have some effect. And as always, you know, it's important to write to your congressmen and your senators and, you know, keep those emails going into those kind of people. I think that's pretty much what can be done.
Great. Well, thanks a lot for speaking with us.
Thank you, Chris.
Okay.
Chris Sturr was the interviewer.
A green plastic watering can for a fake Chinese rubber plant and a fake plastic girl. She bought from a rubber man in a town full of rubber plants to get rid of itself. The world's around. The world's around.
In 1997, Steve Wilson and Jane Acree were investigative reporters employed at Channel 13 in Tampa, Florida, owned by Rupert Murdoch's Fox TV network. They were threatened, offered bribes, ordered to lie, and finally fired when they refused to lie about the health risks of a Monsanto product. In 1998, they filed a lawsuit against Fox TV, which is still moving through the court system. The following interview was recorded shortly after their case was filed. Mike Thornton of KVMR in Nevada City, California, is the interviewer.
Stephen Jane, thank you for being with us on the program. Can you let our listeners know what happened as a result of you covering this story on bovine growth hormone?
Just to set the record straight here, this was supposed to air originally on February 24th of 1997. And we had been given the green light all along as we were in production with the story. They knew what we were doing. They liked what we were doing. They encouraged us to do so, paid for a lot of travel. We went up to, Chicago and Wisconsin and Vermont to do a number of interviews. And, of course, St. Louis, where Monsanto's headquartered. And the story was set to air the 24th. The ads had been purchased. Radio ads promoting it. Everyone was signed off on it. It had gone through a review process, and everyone was excited about its airing. So we got our first letter from Monsanto.
So at first, the story you presented, Fox was very happy with it. They thought it was a really good story, and they were going to air it.
Well, I guess the first real issue was whether or not it was a story, and now four years ago, when the government approved the use of bovine growth hormone in the nation's dairy herd, there was a lot of protest, a lot of scientific protest, a lot of consumer protest, and many big supermarket chains, including Safeway and Vons and here in Florida, Publix and Albertsons. They all said that because of the protest, they weren't going to buy milk from these cows that had been treated with a hormone. And the first issue was that promise kept? And what Jane found from visiting seven big dairy farms at random in the state of Florida was that all seven were using it, and it was in the milk supply throughout the state of Florida and, we believe, through much of the country. So once they found that out, it was a terrific story until, as Jane pointed out, Monsanto hired a very high-powered lawyer in New York to represent them and write a letter to Roger Ailes, who is the former Republican operative who is now head of Fox News, and they put the pressure on Mr. Ailes big time, and then after that, their interest in the story suddenly waned.
Talk, if you will, about the letter and what happened after the receipt of that.
It was quite some letter. In fact, there were two letters. The first letter came on the eve of the broadcast, as Jane said, and it essentially said, of course I'm paraphrasing, that this was a very complicated issue, and these two reporters that you had go look into it obviously aren't smart enough to really understand what the truth of the matter is, and it's been approved by the federal government, therefore we shouldn't have any worries about it. And a lot of other people have said nice things about it, and Monsanto certainly supports it, and therefore, you shouldn't be criticizing it like this. And after the letter came, they postponed the broadcast. The general manager and vice president of the station, who himself was a former investigative reporter, came downstairs, and we had a big meeting, and he looked at it all, and there just weren't any errors of fact. It was a fair piece, a balanced piece. He said, let's run it. But just to make sure that we're bending over backwards to give them every opportunity to say whatever they want, call them up at Monsanto headquarters and offer to go back to St. Louis a second time. And if they've thought of anything else they want to say, let them say it. And let's put it in the piece even further than we have in the first version. Well, when we called and made that offer, that only put them on notice that their first efforts to kill the story had not been successful, and that's when letter number two arrived. And after both of those letters to Mr. Ailes, that was pretty much the death knell, it seemed, from that point on. Those letters, by the way, and all of these documents we're talking about, just so people don't think we're putting our spin on it, are all posted to a website that we've produced, and we've copied the letters, we've scanned them in, and everybody can look at every word of all of the letters and the memos and the scripts that we wanted to broadcast and what Fox wanted us to broadcast. That's all on a special website, which anybody can visit.
It was interesting in the letters from Monsanto. Couldn't quite figure this out. They seemed to understand what we were going to report on. They went point for point, disputing what they believed we were going to report on. And we don't know if they were just very lucky at guessing or if there might have been some other reason, some other way that they knew what our stories contained. We never quite figured that out, but I suppose in the depositions that are upcoming that we will ask that question.
Jane's being polite. Let me be a little more blunt. We wonder if somebody at Fox, if one of their lawyers, if one of their management people might have discussed our scripts and what we were about to broadcast, or maybe even provided our scripts to them to give them an opportunity to make the kinds of complaints that they ultimately made. And we should also point out that we were about to broadcast this on one of 24 television stations that Fox owns. There's a Fox Network, which runs the Fox News Channel and the network news operation out of New York, and then there's a separate division in Rupert Murdoch's empire called the Fox Television Stations. And those are 24 television stations, including the one we were assigned to work at in Tampa, Florida. He owns more television stations, I might point out, than any other individual or company in America, 24 of them. And what happened was this was the station where we were about to broadcast it, but when the pressure from Monsanto came, it went right to Roger Ailes, who technically had nothing to do with it, but whatever they said to Mr. Ailes, he certainly had the clout to pass the word down.
Well, certainly that seems to be the case. I mean, this story is bad enough simply if one were to hear that Fox killed a story that possibly a big corporate entity was upset about. But we do hear about that. That does happen, and unfortunately it happens more and more in American media today. But there's more to this story than simply Fox just killing the story, isn't there?
Yes, and to say that that we filed this breach of contract suit because they killed a story would just be erroneous, because reporters get stories killed all the time. I mean, that's just the way it is. Management has the right to decide which battles they want to fight, and we may not like it. We might complain about it, but, you know, they really do have that right. What they don't have the right to do, though, is to take a story and to fine-tune it and to make it more palatable for their own self-interest. And by that, I mean slanting or distorting the news so that it has more of a Monsanto angle to it. I mean, at one point, our managers were reading directly out of Monsanto-generated literature and telling us, put that in your story, without being able to refute it. And that is what we feel is the basis of our lawsuit, and that is what we feel a television station does not have the right to do.
I just want to go back just to clarify what you said, and that was that people in authority at the station were literally taking what could, I guess, be called Monsanto press release material and information and instructing you to put that in your story and have nothing to counterbalance that.
Yes.
Was that all they did? I mean, that's bad enough. I mean, I'm just wondering, is there more?
No, that is not all they did. We had a couple of reputable scientists who were very adamant critics of the use of this drug. And, I mean, one of them has 3 medical degrees and is a professor at the University of Illinois and has written 8 books on the environmental causes of cancer. And we had to reduce him, instead of putting his credentials in there, which we felt was important, because this isn't just another cancer scare guy from who knows where. I mean, this is a guy who has a background in this area. This is what his area of expertise is. And we had to reduce him down to a scientist in Chicago. We had to take out reputable, well-credentialed, anything like that that would help explain and put him in context. We also had a fellow in Wisconsin who has developed agricultural chemicals for 30 years, and we had to reduce his credentials down to a scientist in Wisconsin. Now, you know, who is this guy? As a viewer, I want to know, is this guy credible? But we really couldn't tell you that. And there were other things that they did as well.
Talk about what those were.
Well, you know, it was as basic as saying things that were just demonstrably untrue. I mean, it's one thing, and everybody sort of expects that a company, and any company does this, they want to put the most favorable spin, the most favorable interpretation on any kind of a story that they don't like. And that's certainly understandable. But this, as you point out, it went way beyond trying to put their industry-friendly spin. It was telling us to broadcast and to allow them to say, without any contradiction, facts that we knew to be false. There are so many of them, I know we don't have the time to go into, but let me just give you one example of the most basic fact of all that we just said, we will never do this because it's wrong. They wanted the report to convey to the viewer that there is no difference between a glass of milk from a cow that was treated with this artificial hormone and a cow that had not had the injections of bovine growth hormone. They wanted us to give the viewer the impression by letting Monsanto say there's no difference in the milk. Now, there is a difference in the milk, and it's an important difference in the milk. Levels of a chemical called IGF-1, insulin-like growth factor, which is a known promoter of cancer, breast cancer, colon cancer, prostate cancer, the levels of IGF-1 are much higher and more potent in the milk from a cow injected with artificial hormone than in the milk from a cow that has had no hormone injections. Now, you can argue that the levels aren't significant. You can argue that, yeah, they're higher, but it won't really hurt you. You can put whatever spin on that you want to, but it is wrong, it's misleading, it's inaccurate, it's unfair to say to the viewer and let the viewer walk away from the broadcast thinking there's really no difference in the milk. That is a perfect example of the kinds of inaccuracies and distortions that they insisted we do.
Fox executives and people in authority at the television station and at the network instructed them, from what I'm hearing you both say, to change the story to make it more favorable to Monsanto Corporation. Does that reasonably sum up what we're discussing here right now?
That's exactly the claim in our lawsuit, that we were ordered to lie, to mislead, to slant, to distort the story, to distort what we knew to be the truth, what we had documented and shown the Fox television people to be the truth. And, you know, as you point out, and as Jane has said, stories are killed from time to time. It's happened since the first newspaper was ever printed, I'm sure. Whenever the newspaper owner or the broadcaster's personal interest or that of his friends or his advertisers get to be more important than the public interest, stories get killed. It's wrong, it shouldn't happen, but it does. And as Jane points out, you know, the freedom of the press belongs to those who actually own the press. And it's their right to decide what stories they want to cover. But when they start telling reporters, we're going to go beyond just not letting you tell a story, we're going to tell you to tell the story in a dishonest and inappropriate and inaccurate and distorted way, you've got to stand up as a reporter and say, wait a minute, that crosses the line, we're not going to do it. And that's what this suit is about.
I mean, we're talking about something, as best as I can understand it, and not in any way, shape, or form pretending to be an expert on bovine growth hormone. But, I mean, it sounds to me that this stuff is potentially dangerous. I mean, potentially very dangerous. And being used, people are making promises that they're not selling products containing bovine growth hormone, and yet they are. You've uncovered this. There are medical and chemical factors regarding bovine growth hormone that make it potentially very dangerous. And here's a major network, news network, television network, trying to cover that story up.
Yeah, I think you make a very important point, and that's one of the reasons we find ourselves suing our former employer. I think if this was a story about, and you run into stories like this all the time, maybe a con man out there who was, had gotten 10 people to invest money, and he ripped them all off, and he ran away with their money. I don't think we'd be here today, but this is a much more important story that has much far-reaching implications than one guy and 10 victims. I mean, milk is primarily consumed by children. And you also bring up an important point. We're not saying that BGH-treated milk causes cancer, because we're not experts and we're not scientists. We can't say that. But we think the public should know that there are public health questions, and some very well-credentialed scientists do believe that, indeed, this is leading to tumor promotion. And the public, at the very least, should have the option when they go to the grocery store of buying milk from treated or untreated cows.
What has happened to the material that you've provided to Fox, be it video or script, whatever you have gathered and garnered in your investigation on this story? Where is that material now?
Well, all of the material that we gathered, of course, we gathered while we were working there, and they had continuous, and still do, access to that material. And one of the interesting points is they said all along, and this is one of the points they're stressing now, they always thought this was an important story. It was a story that viewers ought to know about. It was a story that ought to be told. And yet, we fought for nearly a year to get it on the air in a fair and accurate way and couldn't get them to do it. But more importantly, they fired us on December the 2nd. On April the 2nd, we filed suit 4 months later, and now it's been a couple of weeks after that. What did they do between December the 2nd and today to tell this important story, to let their viewers know what the truth was. Even if they thought we were terrible reporters, and we both have more than 20 years of experience, and we have some rather prestigious awards, and we've been doing this for a while, and neither one of us has ever, you know, been sued and lost or had to give a retraction on the air. I don't think we're that terrible. But even if you buy their argument for a moment that these two reporters were just out of control and they didn't want to tell the truth, they fired us on December the 2nd. What did they do between then and now to get the story out with a reporter they could trust? They've been devoting their time and the efforts of their investigative unit and their resources to doing important investigations like trying to determine which local pizza parlor puts the least cheese on your pizza. They've done nothing. They've done nothing to tell the story to Floridians who were promised this wouldn't be in their milk, that their milk is now riddled with this at every major supermarket in the state. So the protest that they make now, that they believed it was a good story, but they just didn't trust us, that rings a little hollow.
Mm-hmm. You have filed suit against Fox.
We have filed a breach of contract suit because we contend that they cannot fire us for illegal reasons. I'm trying to slant the news would be an illegal reason. And also we are looking for a status under whistleblower status in the state of Florida, which would afford us some protections. We should mention, and a couple of reporters have asked about this, you know, how much money do you hope to be awarded as a result of this? And this is not about money. Early on, about a year ago or so, or shortly after we began having problems, they offered us a buyout to pay our full year salary. The only thing we'd have to do for that, not to come to work, but just to keep our mouths shut about them and how they conduct their business, and about the bovine growth hormone story. They just wanted us to go away. So if this was simply about collecting cash and sitting home by the pool, that you know, clearly doesn't ring true because we could have cashed in a long time ago. If we do win any award under this whistleblower statute, and, you know, the award could go, you know, who knows how high it could go, but there are no limits on that, we are going to, after we recoup our legal expenses and the year's salary that we feel we deserve, we are going to donate it to a journalism foundation so that other reporters who find themselves in the position of choosing between telling the truth or feeding their family maybe get a little help in that area.
We're not after their money. We think they have an obligation to the people who they serve when they use the public airways every night not to lie to those people. And furthermore, I think they have an obligation beyond just not lying to them. I think they have an obligation to go out and look for the truth and to tell it honestly. And they didn't do that in this case. And there are some signs that they don't do it when their own self-interest is involved. That's wrong. The people who have these licenses ought to treat them as the sacred trust that they are. I know that sounds hokey and that sounds maybe pie in the sky, and that's not the way business is done anymore. But, you know, news and journalism and telling the truth on television and radio and in the newspapers didn't used to be the big business that it is now. It was something that broadcasters did because they really wanted to serve the people who let them use the airwaves. Well, you know, those days may have died with people like Bill Paley, but to lie to people, I don't think that's what that television license is for. And if we get, as Jane said, after we pay our expenses and what this has cost us, and we've had to now sell our house and we're having to move and pay enormous legal fees to make this point and to get this story out, because they made it clear to us if we started talking about this story, they would sue us for violation of the clause in our contract that said we could never talk about anything we learned while we were employed there, and that included any story like this that they chose not to air. So after we pay all these expenses, if there's a dollar or $1 million or $20 million, it's our intention that every penny of that go to help the next journalist who finds himself in a position where it's his job or the truth, and we want him or her to be able to stand up for the truth.
I really applaud what you're doing. My concern and my question, I guess, to you is that I know people, journalists like Bob Perry, who tried to tell the Iran-Contra story, people like Gary Webb, who tried to tell it again, have found themselves viciously attacked by corporate media here in the United States, and in many cases have found themselves what amounts to being blacklisted by big media and never really being able to get back into the system in the ways that they were prior to taking the risk in covering controversial stories. Do you have concerns about your future in the industry?
Yeah, I think Steve and I have pretty much decided that we will not be getting too many job offers as a result of this action. We don't expect any to be forthcoming. Once you do something like this, I think that's true. I think you're blacklisted.
I think every broadcaster who owns a television station would ask himself, geez, they might have been right, but what if I don't want to run some story down the road? God, would they threaten to take my license and to complain to the FCC about us? These people are troublemakers. They're loose cannons. They're not the kind of people we want on our staff. And, these decisions are not made by journalists anymore. They're made by bean counters. They're made by people who sell the news like they sell their refrigerators and their television sets. And it's a product to them. And why would you take a risk like this, when you don't have to? There's lots of reporters who'll do what you tell them. In fact, when they threatened to fire us within 48 hours if we wouldn't broadcast their version of this story, he said to us, the general manager, look, we paid $3 billion for these television stations. The news is what we say it is. The news is what we tell you it is. And if you won't do it the way we want it done, regardless of what you think about it, we'll fire you, and I'll simply reassign it to somebody else, and they'll broadcast it the way we think it ought to be told. And I said, if you fire us for that, and you get anybody else at this television station to broadcast what we've just documented is false and inaccurate, we're going to the FCC. And 48 hours came and went, and we weren't fired, and the next thing we knew, we were back in his office being offered an amount of money that approached $200,000, and as Jane pointed out, all we had to do was simply keep our mouth shut and go away and never talk about BGH and never tell mothers and fathers what we know about what's in that milk that they're pouring on their children's cornflakes and never tell anybody about the way that story was handled at Fox Television. That was easy money, and they figured, I suppose, that we'd take it. They didn't know us as well as they thought.
If people wanted to get more information about what was happening regarding your suit against Fox, how would they go about doing that?
www.foxbgh, standing for bovine growth hormone, suit.com. Foxbghsuit.com.
It's always tough to do these kinds of stories, even when you can get them on the air, because in the end people say, gosh, I didn't know that was going on. What can I do? What can I do? I mean, these big companies are making all these decisions. I got to tell you, back when this stuff was approved 4 years ago and consumers went out and they started dumping milk in the streets and they started making it clear that this was something that they didn't want to see in their local milk supply, that got the attention of Safeway and of Vons and of Publix and of Albertsons and of the big grocery chains. And they immediately responded. They said, we hear you. We understand your concern. We will ask our dairy suppliers not to send us milk that has been gathered from cows treated with this hormone. And, they do respond. They respond whenever they think their own economic interest is at stake. And people say, what can you do? Call Safeway. Ask them if it's in the milk. If it is and you don't want it there, and that's your decision to make, you're the one drinking it, tell them so. Tell them you're going to buy your milk elsewhere if that's how you feel. If you feel a television network or a news operation is doing something that you don't agree with, write them and tell them so. There are lots of stations on the dial these days, hundreds of things you can be watching. Let them know that that's important in your decision of where to shop and what television news to watch and what television stations to watch and what commercial products that might be advertised there that you want to buy. It's not my job as a reporter to tell people to go out and start a boycott, but it is my job, I think, as a reporter, and I think every journalist's job, to get the truth out. And as you said, this is really a right to choose. And you can't make a choice unless you know what's going on. And all I'm saying is, this is what's going on. You need the information before you can make an informed choice. If you think BGH is the greatest thing since sliced bread, terrific. That's your choice to make. If, on the other hand, you say, as many people have, what is the benefit to me? The price of milk isn't going down. It's going up just like everything else. There's not a shortage of milk. God, we were paying farmers millions of tax dollars to dump milk and price supports until just recently. What is the benefit to the consumer? And I don't think it's taking a position to say that there really is no benefit to the consumer, and the risk is something that each individual has to judge. Is there smoking gun evidence that this promotes cancer? No. There is a lot of evidence that suggests that, and the evidence, I think, fair to say, is certainly persuasive enough that has caused this stuff to be banned throughout Europe. It's banned in New Zealand, in Australia, and several other countries. It's never been approved in Canada, despite what the regulatory officials there said was an effort by Monsanto to bribe them. They reported that to the government officials there. That wasn't just a charge. It was a documented charge that was made. So you have to decide that, but you can't make a decision unless you know. And if you think it's wrong for them to slip it by you, and if you think it's wrong for news organizations to cover it up, let them know how you feel. And on our website, you can fax some of these people for free and let them know how you feel. That's the best advice I can give.
And let me also say, for consumers, the way that you can verify that this is your milk products come from BGH, cows that are not treated, with BGH, is to see an affidavit from the farmer or the producer that is actionable in court if it isn't true, that says that, you know, I am committed to the no BGH use, and they'll write that down if they're not using it. And then in California, you have some organic standards and third-party verification and all. And it also must come from the whole co-op, because milk is co-mingled. So the whole dairy co-op has got to be committed to this BGH-free concept. You can't just be one producer. It doesn't work that way.
And while it's important to talk about the issue of BGH here, I think it's also important for the listeners to realize, at least in my opinion, that we're talking about something that's even bigger than this, because so many people look to television news thinking, or at least hoping, that they're being told some reasonable facsimile of the truth. And while you two were courageous enough to turn down the hush money, the question is, of course, is how many reporters may have not had that level of courage and have accepted it, whether it be for Monsanto's BGH or some other corporate interest. And that, I think, is the real overarching issue here. Steve Wilson and Jane Akre, thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thanks for inviting us.
Thank you.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us through our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. You can also download shows you may have missed or get more info on the topics covered. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content. Just like